The people who lived in darkness have seen a great light, the prophet Isaiah told us long ago back in Advent as we were awaiting the birth of the Christ child. We're now in the season of Epiphany when we experience the light of Christ shining out into the world. But today's text tugs at us to go back to Isaiah, not to those hopeful words from chapter 9, but to a different situation that is the setting for chapter 62. The entire book of Isaiah spans three different eras in the history of Israel: warning, exile, and homecoming. We're in the homecoming part in chapter 62. Israel was punished for her sin in the destruction of the temple and the exile to Babylon. The people spent a few generations in exile in Babylon, and now, in the last part of Isaiah, they have returned to their land. The great Persian leader Cyrus defeated Babylon and recognizes that the people of Israel desire to go home. And so he not only allows that, he enables that. They had such high hopes for that homecoming. At last, their land. Sure, the temple would be hard to rebuild, but oh, what a project. They would be on their land, the land promised to them by God, the land flowing with milk and honey. But when they come home, they see not milk and honey, but dried up streams and rubble. They see not vineyards dripping with grapes, but fields that have lain fallow for too long. They see not their homes and their neighbors, but desolation. They wonder if they're still being punished by God. They wonder if they will ever know shalom, peace, wholeness, prosperity. Do we not want those same things? Peace, wholeness, and prosperity? I have to tell you that some mornings I spring out of bed and go downstairs and drink my coffee and do my crossword puzzle, and I'm glad to start the day. But other mornings, I awake to the sound of rain, and my mind starts going, and I think about the situation in Syria and the refugees, and then I think about all those children separated from their parents at our borders, and I think about poverty and gentrification and homelessness here in Portland, and getting out of bed seems like a pretty bad wager to make. Maybe you feel that way too. Maybe you don't. And that's your prerogative, and not being weighed down by these things does help one to get out of bed in the morning. But for some of us, it's so painful to acknowledge that some of God's children in the world today experience what those children of Israel experienced some 2,500 years ago: fear and bewilderment, despair, and all those things that do not make for peace. This weekend, as our city and our nation hold events in memory and in celebration of the birthday of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the unfulfilled work of his legacy has been on my mind. The work he and others set out to do resonates with this Isaiah text for me. I see images of despair and rebuilding on the foundation of hope and reconciliation. And I think about our own situation here in this little northeast corner of Portland. When we moved here 7.5 years ago, I was surprised to learn that only 6 to 8% of Portland's population is African American. I'd lived in the Midwest and on the East Coast and in Texas, where there's more racial diversity. As I settled into my new life as a Portlander, I learned more about the city's history, about the Vanport flood of 1948, which destroyed the life of Vanport's 40,000 citizens, over 10% of whom were African American. I learned about the displacement of the Black community in the Albina neighborhood with the expansion of Emmanuel Hospital and the building of the I-5 corridor straight through the middle of that neighborhood. I learned about unfair eminent domain practices and redlining that prevented people of color from buying homes in some neighborhoods. When our daughter started kindergarten at a nearby school, it was a Title I school, meaning over 60% of its students were on free and reduced lunch. Because of gentrification and rising home costs and differently incomed people moving into the neighborhood, the school is no longer a Title I, but not because the situation of the families there have improved. And remember, the vast majority of Title I schools in Portland Public School District, are in Northeast Portland. I was fascinated by the recent debate in the city council elections about the right of return program. The Guardian newspaper describes it well. The program gives down payment assistance to first-time homeowners who were displaced or at the risk of displacement from the city's north and northeast neighborhoods because of urban renewal. And listen to this next sentence. It falls under, the one after that. It falls under a city plan that delegates how $20 million will be spent on affordable housing. And listen to this. In an effort to atone for the sins of gentrification. Some running for office fully endorsed this program. Others asked why folks would want to return to their old neighborhood when it no longer looked or felt or had the things that made for home. It's all here in Portland, just as it was all there in Isaiah. The prophet spoke to a people who felt forsaken by the powers that be, and worse, forsaken by God. They came home not to overflowing vineyards and a shiny new temple, but to desolation. They called themselves those names, forsaken and desolation. But the prophet did, as prophets do. He offered a word of hope to this downcast people. No, the prophet said, pleading his case to God on behalf of the people. No, it will not always be this way. So deeply did Isaiah love his people, and so grounded was he in his call that he could not keep silent. He spoke of a future, of hope, of crowns and diadems, of new names and new identities, of a wedding, all of which would lead to shalom, to peace, wholeness, and prosperity. How would that happen? Through the grace and love of God, of course, who would inspire the people and give them what they needed to rebuild their lives, their temple, their city, and their nation. And the people who stayed in Israel, who were not exiled, would work with those who had been exiled and who had come back. It would take a while. It takes a long time to build a temple. It takes a long time to plant a vineyard that will bear fruit. It takes a long time to rebuild community. It would take faith and patience and hard work. It would also take a reimagining of who the people were. They were not forsaken. They were delighted in. They were not desolate. They were married, which is to say they were loved and cherished and committed to. They did not wear rags. They were crowned in the finest jewels that would reflect the light of their nation. History tells us that these people did eventually know shalom. The temple was rebuilt. They prospered so much that new prophets had to come and warn them of their excesses. God was faithful to them, and for a while, indeed, they knew peace. They knew shalom. I wonder if and when we will know peace and shalom in Portland. Greg and I plan to be here for a while. We might even retire here, but that's a long way off. Still, I feel a commitment to the wholeness of this city, to the peace of our neighborhood, and to the prosperity not just of some, but the prosperity of all. I wonder if we might take anything that the prophet says and learn from it and have some hope for some of those things that make it hard for us to get out of bed in the morning. Before we get to hope, I think we need to acknowledge that right here in our city and in our neighborhood and maybe even in the congregation this morning, there are people who feel forsaken and desolate. They feel invisible, forgotten, demeaned as having less value. They feel pushed out, exiled even. Some feel forsaken and desolate because they have been the victims of persistent and systemic racism. Racism is an ugly fruit that was born out of the ashes of slavery here in the U.S., and I sometimes wonder if we will ever, ever recover from the sins of slavery. Dismantling racism is hard and slow work. Dr. King was a prophet when he said that the arc of history is long. It is so long that sometimes we can't see that bend toward justice. But we show up and we do our part because God calls us to join God in the work of reconciliation, and simply because that's what neighbors do. Dismantling the devastation of racism requires work at the individual and the systemic level. And if you're interested in being a part of this work, let me suggest three ways you can begin to make a difference. The first is this: to seek in your heart, in your soul, in your gut, the desire for shalom for everyone. There is no room for hate in this work of reconciliation. There's no space to call anyone an enemy. On Thursday, Greg and I attended a luncheon that was for pastors and law enforcement. It's about a new initiative that the city, that the police department, with Chief Daniel Outlaw, is trying to get, where congregations are in a really good relationship with the beat cops in their neighborhood. It's a program started by a Black Baptist pastor in Atlanta in response to some of the tension between the police department and communities of color. And as he spoke, this pastor from Atlanta, he reminded all of us there of one of the foundations of Dr. King's work, that the work of civil rights was never to destroy enemies, but to make allies out of enemies. There are no enemies. Only neighbors and allies and people who will eventually become our neighbors and our allies. Recognizing that our neighbors and our allies like us are worthy of shalom, of peace, wholeness, and prosperity is a first step. The second may be the hardest: to confront attitudes of prejudice and racism in your own heart. There are 1,000 ways to do that depending on your personality. You might seek out an accountability partner, someone that you can admit things to. You might journal about what you see in your assumptions and attitudes. You might take full advantage of the silent prayer of confession. You might read a book about racism or white privilege. You might attend any number of events in Portland that address this issue. But if we don't confront the sin that we carry within ourselves, we will never realize the depth of grace that we need. And the third is this: find a way to advocate for laws and policies that free us up rather than enforce an unjust status quo, especially locally. Tax policies can affect poverty. Voting to fund schools can help all those Title I schools. The city has created a racial equity toolkit, which for how it does business, and I think we can see some hope in that. Over the past few years, different members of the congregation have spoken with Greg and me about the church addressing this issue of racism, and in a few weeks, we're having a conversation with these self-identified stakeholders. We hope to present some more to you after that meeting. Last year, there was a group that read the book America's Original Sin, Racism, White Privilege, and A Bridge to a New America, and I understand they had some lively discussions there. We hope to offer some more opportunities for the congregation to engage in this work that is nothing less than holy. Well, there is much rebuilding to be done. The opportunity before us is not unlike the opportunity before those people in Israel's time. Will we answer the call to do the hard work, to ask the hard questions of ourselves and of others, to do our part to reconcile the world, even if we don't live long enough to see the end of it? Do we believe that all the world deserves God's shalom, peace, wholeness, and prosperity for all? I'd like to leave you today with some thoughts that Dr. King had some 60 years ago about this, and I've just added a couple words to make his words a little more inclusive. He said, "Through our scientific and technological genius, we have made of this world a neighborhood, and yet we have not had the ethical commitment to make of it a brotherhood or sisterhood. But somehow, and in some way, we have got to do this. We must all learn to live together as brothers and sisters, or we will all perish together as fools. We are tied together in the single garment of destiny, caught in an inescapable network of mutuality. And whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. And for some strange reason, I can never be what I ought to be until you are what you ought to be. And you can never be what you ought to be until I am what I ought to be. This is the way God's universe is made. This is the way God's universe is structured. May we all work together toward shalom and to being what we ought to be. Amen."